Wake up, America. It's Morning Air with John Morales.
Si, senor.
Sarah Tafoya.
It's my mom.
And Glenn Leverins.
Bringing the light of Christ to start your day.
That's how I know.
This is Morning Air on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us here. Welcome to getting another summer week underway with Morning Air on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. John is off today. Glenn and Sarah holding down the fort, as it were. Sarah, how was your weekend?
Oh, Glenn, thanks so much for asking. Yeah, it was a fun weekend. We had some birthday celebrations in our household this weekend. Me and my husband both have birthdays in July. My son, his birthday is the end of June. So we had a little combo platter, everybody, which is really nice for me because my birthday's at the end of the month. So I got my birthday presents early. So that was pretty cool. The difference between kid birthday presents and adult birthday presents. Okay, Glenn, my son got like remote control cars. He got an electric scooter. He got like these cool shoes he's been waiting for. And I got pots and pans. And I mean, these are the gifts I need, right? These are things I don't want to have to buy. I'm like, those pots are fine. And they're like, you know, everything's always sticking to it. I definitely need a new one. So I'm not complaining. I got a toaster. I mean, it's when you're pressing down for the toaster to work and it pops right back up, you need a new toaster. So I was trying to push off on those, and I have some wonderful family members who noticed how desperate my life living situation was, and they blessed me with those things. But it's interesting when you're an adult, you're excited to get those things, even though, you know, they're not the exciting, extravagant gifts and toys that you know, when you're a kid that you're looking forward to.
I think that is a sign of maturity, to be excited for things like toasters. And, you know, every once in a while you need new socks and some of those things run out. But my goodness, there's great family folklore in my wife's family about a toaster. And she was camping with her mom and dad and nearby in another campsite, her grandma and grandpa. And she was walking by her folks' camper one day and, you know, narrowly missed getting hit by a toaster being flung out the door of the camper because it apparently wasn't working very well. And mom had just had enough. And Grandpa figured out that, you know, every once in a while you need to open that little hatch on the bottom and let the crumbs escape. And that's what fixed the toaster. I don't know if it had much impact damage from flying out the door, but yeah, maybe a new toaster would have been in order as well. But oh, for birthday presents, it was my wife's grandma's 97th birthday on Friday.
And that's so exciting.
Yeah, she had a great time and had help from little great-grandchildren, too, blowing out 97 candles. We had something that held 100 candles. And,
wow. You
know, it was getting warm in the room. It's like, let's light these and blow them out before the smoke detector comes
on. Did you have someone on standby with, like, a fire extinguisher just in case, like, things got out of control?
Well, that was mentioned. The house was on a lake, and so, you know, maybe we could have all, you know, run down there and got a bucket if need be. But I tell you, one time, it was several years ago, but my wife was turning 31 at the time, and we were staying with my folks for literally like a month and a half between moves and getting to a different house. And we cobbled together every candle we could find, and lo and behold, you know, with moms who'd never throw anything out, we found 31 candles, stuck them on a regular cake. See, the thing with the grandma, they were on a separate stand, you know, it was 100 candles. But we stuck 31 on a cake along with some other little clowns and little decorations, and actually, upon lighting all those candles, some of the little decorations caught on fire, too.
Oh, buddy.
And so after that, it was just kind of the numerals, you know, whatever the birthday was. It was two candles, basically, with two numerals, and that was a safer way to go. But here's just to safe birthdays for everyone.
Yeah, right. Just as a hazard, just in case. Yeah, usually what we do when you have the big numbers is, you know, one row of candles is that number. The second row of candles is the other one. So if you're celebrating 13, there's one and three. Let's not go crazy here.
Oh, you know, and so here's to birthday fire safety. So folks with extra candles aren't feeling bad enough already, right? But we should be celebrating. It's another year the Lord has given us.
So true.
Someone who's a pro at lighting those birthday candles with five little ones at home now and counting. And she's busy being a mom and also a great pro-life worker, having led pregnancy help centers in the past, done work with Students for Life, and co-hosting Living the Gospel of Life, a pro-life radio show on our Relevant Radio affiliate in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Relevant Radio 1330. Angela Erickson joins us from the greater Twin Cities area this morning. Angela, great to have you along.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me on this morning.
We appreciate you taking the time, especially in an always busy household, to join us and talk to us about life issues and also about the joy of being a mom. And, you know, it's, of course, busy and challenging. But I think part of it, too, if we can, you know, help people to realize that, you know, talking about kids isn't all just being cynical about, oh, it's so busy and there goes your life now, but that it can indeed be a joyful thing. But you've worked long and hard in your young life for various pro-life causes, and I'm just wanting your take here, since we haven't had a chance to really chat about it since Roe v. Wade was overturned and the furious backlash around the U.S., including the state in which you live, Minnesota. What do you think right now with what you're seeing?
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting time, I think, moving forward in our country. I think we're going to see, obviously, a lot of battle lines kind of redrawn, right? I mean, here in Minnesota already, pro-abortion advocates have already succeeded in getting a lot of pro-life laws overturned since the ruling, which is really concerning. I think, you know, it's nice to focus on the states in which abortion is now going to be illegal or severely minimized, but there's a reality that abortion is going to expand in other states like ours. So, which is hard to believe, because in Minnesota, abortion is still legal up to birth. In fact, as recent as 2016, there was an abortion committed on a child as late as 36 weeks, according to the annual data here in the state of Minnesota. So really concerning stuff. And there's no doubt that the pro-choice side has been preparing for this moment as well, and has been finding new ways to promote and push abortion and expand it, even in states where it will be restricted. So there's a lot of, we have a lot of work to do.
Big rally over the weekend in front of the state capitol in St. Paul. Local paper reporting that thousands were on hand, giving it more coverage than any of the annual pro-life marches that had happened there through the years. Do you see, too, kind of a political angle to this? In Minnesota, abortion has been legal, and depending how the legislature might turn out in the fall, it would take a while to change it. But it isn't like when Roe v. Wade was overturned that any access to abortion was limited instantly in Minnesota. Do you think people are being kind of scared to turn out at the polls, scared to encourage to be turned out at the polls?
Yeah, I think there are two things going on here. That's a good question. First of all, I think a lot of Americans are, and I'm sure you guys have covered it extensively here on Relevant Radio, but a lot of Americans don't really understand what it meant when Roe versus Wade was overturned. And so you're speaking about a lot of people who just are ignorant about what this meant for the country and what it means for each state individually. So, yes, I think there's part of it is an ignorance about what this means here. And the second part is, yes, I do think that Democrats feel like this is a winning issue for them right now. But the truth is that abortion really isn't a winning issue, especially when prices at the gas pump are the highest that they've ever been. Groceries are, you know, most families are paying on average $500 more on groceries every month, according to some economists. So, you know, we have real tangible problems that we're seeing every day that are affecting our pocketbooks every day. And abortion is something that the average American isn't seeing happen every day. So it's going to be really hard for them to keep up kind of emotions on this and get the turnout that they want come November. So they can try, but I don't think it will be as successful.
Many pro-lifers are grounded in their faith. That keeps them motivated and going strong. But do you find in doing pro-life work, we almost need to kind of buck up the pro-lifers, because, like you were just saying, in terms of elections even, abortion actually not the biggest issue out there. But if you were just to kind of absorb the press that one is seeing in the paper, TV, radio, etc., it would seem like the sky is falling and that's the biggest issue that we've ever had.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that's part of the machine, right, is to gin up outrage about everything. I mean, I sort of feel like if we're not taking a step back from what we're seeing in the mainstream media, I mean, that's what makes outlets like Relevant Radio so wonderful, is that people have a place to tune in and plug into their faith. Because sometimes tuning into the mainstream media can be overwhelming. I think it can leave us feeling discouraged. And we do need to be promoting and helping support our pro-life advocates, those who are involved in the movement, doing our part to pray for them and find practical ways within our communities to make sure that our communities are supporting life. So I think that will help ease some of that, I don't know, anxiety we might be experiencing, just knowing that there are resources available and that we're doing everything that we can to provide those resources.
I was pro-life before my children were born, but I remember holding that first one and she never hit the ground because not only did we not drop her, which was a good thing, but that I'm aware of, but find out later my wife went down the steps a couple times as a little kid. And it's like, oh, you know, and that's finally admitted by her mom years later. That explains a lot. But what a miracle. You're just holding that baby for the first time, and wow, you're more pro-life than ever. But I want to talk a little bit, Angela, about just the positive witness that being as large a family as the Lord gifts you with, but to be able to, you know, as much as of a challenge of it is, but you like to be able to take your kids out in situations where it's maybe not always even easy to have a bunch of kids along, but to be a pro-life witness, just living out a joyful life with lots of kids and trying to normalize that once again as it used to be.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I sort of feel like we live in a time where children are not allowed to have a place in the public sphere. They're sort of expected to be cast aside until they're older and can quote unquote handle themselves. But that's just not how kids are. Their brains are developing and they're learning how to use their bodies. They don't know how to sit still for a long time. So yeah, I think we need to normalize how children behave because that's just how they are wired biologically and physiologically. I think being able to be in the public square and be joyful about it helps people reconsider kind of this culture that we have that embraces sterilization on demand. I can't tell you how often strangers will tell me about having had themselves or their spouse sterilized, kind of as a way of saying to me, thank goodness I'm not you, because I have 5 young children and my oldest is turning 7 next month. But really, I think too, sometimes you hear the sad stories too of spouses whose husband had a vasectomy against their wishes. And you can see the hurt that is conveyed in those moments. And I think the reality is that women are afraid to embrace motherhood. We've been raised in a culture that really tells women that motherhood is scary. And I think we just need to normalize it. And the only way we can normalize it is displaying it and doing the best that we can to show people that it's not scary and you will survive if you have more than 2 or 3 kids.
Angela, Sarah, our producer and co-host as well, a mom of many, all swinging away at that birthday party pinata over the weekend too. But Sarah, have you felt that, you know, being able to just, you know, take your family along, whatever size it happens to be at the time, in a joyful and challenging way, but can be a good witness for life?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's always funny because when you have different family members or friends or even neighbors, just yesterday I had a conversation with one of our neighbors and she has 3 kids and I have 4. And she said, oh, are you guys done? And I was just like, well, I was like, maybe. Because obviously you don't know what God has in store for your family. I mean, I feel like we could be done, but there's always that question. Are you done? You know, like after you've had 2, people are like, are you done? You're done yet? You know, it's kind of like, how do you answer that? Because, you know, there is that feeling out there that after 2, especially if you have a boy and a girl, that you should be done, right? You got everything you wanted. But God knows better than any of us what we really want or need and can handle. And obviously there are challenges with having many children, and there's challenges with having just one because they want you to entertain them all the time. So there's challenges with any family size, and obviously going to the grocery store with many children and having them all behave can be challenging at certain times and their different ages and stages. But it's also, I find, you know, a very beautiful way, like Angela was saying, a very beautiful way to show others that, like, look, it's possible, and yes, there's ups and downs, but there's also very beautiful things because if you got older kids helping out younger kids, and that's beautiful to see that, you know, that's an experience that not all families have. When you just have one child, they don't have that experience of obviously fighting with a sibling, but also helping and teaching a sibling how to tie their shoes or ride their bike or something that that older child enjoys and passes on to a younger one. Something as a parent you get to enjoy, but not always as a sibling. So there's a lot of ups and downs with family life, no matter what the size, but it's beautiful to be able to have that larger family, if that is what God is going to bless you with, and sharing that with others to say, this is not weird. This is just part of our life. This could be part of your life if that's what God's calling you to, but this is the way it is.
Angela, do we just need to normalize once again having larger families and letting God decide how many more?
Oh, I mean, of course I'm going to say yes. but, you know, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, it wasn't until maybe the last 100 years that fertility rates really tanked. I mean, the average family size was 7 or 8 kids up until a little over 100 years ago, I believe, if I'm recalling my research correctly. So this is a really unusual time, honestly, to see only 1 or 2 kids per family. I sort of feel like if you have the third kid, people look at you like, oh, maybe that one was an accident. And then the fourth kid, then people look at you like, that must have been on purpose. What are you doing? So yeah, we do need to normalize it. And, you know, and I think too, as parents, then that comes back to us. Like how do we embrace God's call for us in our family lives and discerning our own family size? Because at least what I found, we've never necessarily planned most of our kids. I usually find out I'm pregnant by the first birthday of the youngest child. And sometimes that's been really overwhelming depending on the season. But what I have found is that God is just so faithful. And it's like he uses our biggest fears to strengthen our faith and heal us in ways that we did not anticipate. And so I feel like when we're without good cause, you know, preventing that from happening. I mean, the only thing that can come out of more life is more love, right? And we just have to find ways to lean into that and accept God's grace when those situations arise. And what better way to do that than embracing new life within your family and then bringing that out into the world? So it all starts in our domestic church.
In the beauty of that large family with the older kids helping the younger kids, quite often through the years, we've done a silent auction item where we take some folks from a Catholic school in Minnesota and go visit the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help and the Shrine to St. Joseph in Relevant Radio, the old headquarter location in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and some of the great holy things, and even the Shrine to Football if they want at Lambeau over there. And one year, the silent auction winners was a large family of, I think at the time, 8 kids, and I think it's up to maybe 10 or 11 now. Beautiful
13.
Family with one of the giant one of the, wow, that's awesome, with one of those giant vans with about 4 bikes on the back. And you know, we met him over there and we're hanging out, and you know, the baby at the time, it was like the job of everyone else, maybe the oldest 3-4 kids, to make sure the baby was held and kissed constantly. It seemed that was the job, was to be kissing the baby. But the way the older kids took care of the young kids, and I never forget, we were while the mom and my wife were needing a stop for coffee, we were waiting out in the parking lot with the kid and the dads and talking, and an ambulance went by. And in a moment, Dad would lead the kids in a prayer for safety for that situation. But I saw the oldest kid do that on his own, even before the you know, Dad spoke up and said, "Hey, let's pray for the situation." And they were doing it right, and in such a joy. And Angela, too, I don't know if you're starting to notice this, but it's just anecdotal, but some of the beautiful families I know with 7, 8, 9, 10 or more kids, the parents, maybe the moms especially, seem pretty relaxed. And not that they are, but it's just they seem that way. And you know, the peace they've been blessed with by the Lord, or just kind of giving up the fight and going with the flow. But I noticed, you know, it's almost inverse to what society would have you think.
Yeah, I think you just realize so much more is out of your control. So I do think it is partly you give up a little bit. I mean, in terms of trying to helicopter and be involved in everything, you're more prone to let your kids work out their own fights. Because honestly, you would spend all day breaking up fights if you weren't letting them work through those things together. And that's another beautiful thing about having a large family, is a lot of the skills that kids get playing in sports or some of these other things like teamwork and diligence, dedication, all those things, you actually can learn those in a big family as well. I think part of it is just that you realize so much of it is out of your control. And then, yeah, you do have to kind of lean on God that way and say, all right, Jesus, take the wheel. I can't do this right now. So you're going to have to deal with this.
Also, with big families not being as common as they used to be, do you find that they become a support system for one another? You're talking with someone that has more than two or three kids, and you're sharing something not only in the practical sense in how to deal with that many children, but dealing with maybe some accidental at times pushback from society.
Yeah, I think a lot of us. I'm part of a homeschooling community. We homeschool, and you do tend to see larger families homeschooling. And so I do think we become a pretty big support system for each other because we just realize how desperately that's needed. We live at a time where a lot of women are working. And so some of those traditional support structures just are no longer available. You don't have stay-at-home moms all coming together in the neighborhood and kids playing together. You do kind of have to forge your own community in a way that maybe we didn't have to in the past. So, I think we have to be more intentional about that. And most of us have found that is really, it just makes the world of a difference when you're trying to raise your children in a loving environment, especially in a culture that really does embrace death in a lot of ways.
Well, Angela, we appreciate your time so much this morning, knowing it's busy with those five little ones at home, but continued blessings on raising those good little guys and all the good pro-life work you do as well. And on the weekends, folks can check out Living the Gospel of Life on Relevant Radio 1330 in the Twin Cities. Angela, along with Brian Gibson, who we've had on Morning Air before, too, with Pro-Life Action Ministries. Again, thanks for joining us this morning. We continue up next, or around the corner, we're going to talk with Bruce Lockenhauer, continue our discussion on how to deal with maybe some age discrimination in the workplace and looking for new jobs when you have a lot of experience. That's coming up as Morning Air continues here on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Bringing the light of Christ to start your day. This is Morning Air
on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Get connected to the conversation. 888-914-9149.
888-914-9149.
Thanks for joining us for Morning Air here on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app. John's off today. It's Glenn along with Sarah, producer Gabby in-house as well today. Thanks for joining us. Yeah, our story corner coming up before the end of the hour. It's a classic one I dug up and hadn't seen in a while. And I tell you, it's a little difficult to get through. It's so good, you know. We've been known to make the mascara run on occasion today. Might be one of those days as well. Well, Bruce Lockenhauer is with us. He's a regular guest, a career coach, helping us to find our way to maybe a better job if we need one of those, a job if we really need something, and how to navigate. And what we've been talking about the last several weeks here is age discrimination, one of those kinds of discriminations that seeps into the workplace and making it a little harder for people with maybe a lot of great experience to get hired. Doesn't seem to make sense from a business standpoint. Hey, good morning, Bruce. Great to have you along today.
Good morning, Glenn. A joy to be here, as always. Thank you.
Well, it seems like we had so much to talk about last week when we talked a little bit about dealing with age discrimination. We want to pick that up again this week and look at some good strategies for folks looking for work or looking to improve a little bit. I would imagine, too, for an older worker, on one hand, if they've lost a job and need one, that's one thing. But in terms of if they're looking to make a change, is there a point where we're getting close to retirement where, well, it's just better to ride it out? Or do we need to be brave in a certain sense to, maybe think we've got one more lap left in us and we want to change and make that the best possible way to go?
Yeah, I had breakfast with a friend last week, and he's turning 60 in February, and he just made a big move. After more than 10 years at his current employer, he set out on a new adventure. And he said, my parents didn't live beyond their 60s, and I want to have the last chapter be fun, new, and exciting. So it depends. Every situation is different. And, Glenn, as we talked about the 12 steps, we talked about the importance of discerning prayerfully what that next step should be. And I would encourage people to solicit input from those that know them well, including our Lord, to you get that input and then go in and into a chapel, find the Blessed Sacrament, find a quiet time, read a gospel scene and put yourself in that scene and ask our Lord, Lord, that I may see, what do you have in store for me? What should I be thinking about? Because the market out there, and we talked about it last time, it's still pretty vibrant. And if for whatever reason a worker, be they experienced or not, finds themselves in a situation where they're just not thriving, either professionally or personally, they ought to consider looking, because now's the time. I'm always a believer in carpe diem and seizing the moment. With the economy going the way it's going, that job market won't be as robust as it is forever.
You know, when I was in college as a young radio guy looking to get that first job, and during college times, just piling up as much related as experience as I could get, you know, managing the college radio station and interning at a real station, doing wedding dances and club dances and public address announcing at sporting events, and even being president of the Radio TV Guild. And what a radio geek I was. Mm-hmm. My goodness, you wanted as much stuff to put on the resume as possible. But as you go along in life, not only does it get too long in a practical sense, falling over to that second page, which sometimes we don't like, but talk about the need to tailor that resume so we don't appear to be too much overqualified, even if we might be a little overqualified, but really still want to do that job.
Well, you know, yeah, overqualified can mean a whole bunch of different things. And principally it means from an employer that you look like you've done so much that I'm fearful you won't be happy doing what I have in mind for you. And then secondly, you've done so much and have so much experience, you're going to be far too expensive for me to hire you. And those are two things that need to be addressed, because you do, and you're right. We turn the whole process on its head, that process being finding and landing your dream job and the 12 steps involved with it. Because when you are coming out of college, you are trying to fill that one-page resume. But an experienced worker could have difficulty consolidating it to two pages if they want to include everything on there. So, you know, I want to propose we spend a little time, Glenn, talking about the 12 steps to finding and landing your dream job through the lens of an experienced worker. Because just as you suggested, from the resume, you know, from start to finish, the process has subtle differences. And those subtle differences are the difference between getting a bunch of offers, and I've got examples, or not.
Well, one of your first steps there, it talks about something you mentioned, even an older worker discovering the dream, or if they have one more dream they'd like to see to fulfillment before retirement times come.
That's right. Discover your dream. And we talked about just a moment ago, somebody who might be thinking, should I see this out or should I start a new chapter? And the advantage of an experienced worker is that experienced workers know themselves. You know, they know what they're good at. They know what their passions are. They know what they like. A younger worker may need some help in just getting some additional input. I always encourage getting outside input. But at this stage, you know yourself, and you can take what you know about yourself, those competencies and passions, and look. There are two places I suggest you look to start some thoughts about what might be next. One is the Labor Department site, OccupationsNet. It's pretty cool. I was happy when I first discovered it. But the other place, and it matches your competencies and passions to jobs out there, so it'll give you some ideas of some jobs, and then you can investigate those further. The other thought, though, is going back in your Rolodex. Thanks to LinkedIn, you can track down people you worked with, Glenn, when you were in that radio association, and see what those folks are doing. And that'll give you another interesting slate of ideas of what you might be doing just based on what some other people are doing. So, and
it's odd,
you know,
that,
it's...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, please.
Well, I was just going to say, it maybe seems odd that people might think Americans might be thoughtful in any particular way. But in terms of a little downtime during COVID, perhaps... You know, and with the Great Resignation, do you believe it's really been part, not just financially, but people spending a little more time thinking about how they want to be spending their work time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was jarring for people to stop commuting, to be at home, you know, to set up their home office and work via Zoom and work remotely. And it caused people, I like calling it the Great Reawakening, It's called the Great Reshuffling, etc. But people, I believe, were reawakened to what's important in life. All of a sudden, they had not only dinner, but maybe breakfast and or lunch with the family. They were able to do things together and spend more time, less time on the road commuting and more time working and, you know, being with the family. So I think people got reawakened to say, you know, maybe the job that I'm in isn't the best fit for me after all, because they were forced to take a step back. And that's, I think, is what the principal driver behind that great resignation, the high quit rate and the reshuffling that took place. And that's not bad. I think change is good. When change happens, productivity increases. But more importantly, I think people have had a chance to stop and say what's important in life. Because you're right, Glenn, we Americans are known for our work ethic, which is good and bad. Because you don't get that time back, and at your eulogy, people don't say, "Oh, Bruce was such a hard worker," you know. But no, they say, "Bruce, you know, our Lord will ask you, how well did you love?" So, yes, so indeed, so it has been a great time for people to stop and think what's most important, and make sure that their professional environment is aligned with what their personal and supernatural goals are.
Not too late for that new dream. Career coach Bruce Lochenour with us this morning for Morning Air. Our number is 888-914-9149. If you've got a question or comment, would like some advice on how maybe as a worker with a little more gray hair, how to take that next step as we get back to kind of the 12 good steps at finding that next best place for you. Bruce, one of those is, again, it maybe plays into how much experience we have or not, and tailoring that experience with our marketing materials, including but not limited to the resume.
Yes, yes. So we've talked about this, how it's important for any person looking for a new job to make sure that everything's aligned and hopefully targeting what that job description suggests you should portray. Everything being your resume, your LinkedIn profile, and your social media. Now, for the experienced worker, the social media is a wonderful environment that presents an opportunity to address those stereotypes that we talked about before. So I would encourage our experienced workers to look at their social media and make sure that it is underscoring what will address those common stereotypes, that they are a high energy person, that they are a lifelong learner, that they are collaborative, that they're tech savvy, that they're fun. So I think about a buddy of mine, a gentleman a bunch of years older than I am, who retired but is still very active. And, you know, I see, yeah, he posts pictures of him, you know, deep sea fishing and jet skiing and this and that, you know, and I think, gee whiz, are you sure you want to be retired? You need to use the social media. But then back to the resume, because you hit on that very, very well. And once you figure out, Glenn, when we started the show here, once you figure out what it is you're going for, look at a job description and tailor that resume to that job description. And unlike early on, where more is more early in your career, at this stage, less is more. You need to make it tightly focused on providing evidence of what you've done that is specifically aligned with that job, with that job description tells you. Glenn, you also just want to have like the last 10 years, maybe 15 of experience. You might want to consider not including graduation dates, because you want the employer to focus on what you've done most recently, which aligns with what they need done. So the when you have less, by the way, Glenn, and a recruiter looks at your resume, they're going to be enticed to call you and ask you for more. If you have too much, they're going to read and go, oh, you know, there's just too much here, and toss it aside and go on to the next one. So having that second step, aligning your marketing materials, they need to be well aligned, and they need to be lean and mean and focused on what you're trying to achieve.
You know, and along those lines there too, realizing that the job of the resume, right, is to get to the next step, whether it's the phone interview or the actual in-person interview. And is it really important to remember, just from a practical sense, at whatever age we are and however much experience we have, that each piece is just designed to lead to the next step, and that we don't need to start with the novel first, but just get the person who's doing the hiring to turn the page?
Exactly right. Or in this case, to send an email or pick up the phone and call you. So less is more. At this stage on your resume, less is more. two pages are fine, but make it tightly focused on what you're gunning for here, and really trim it and make it so that there's enough to tease, and that's true of LinkedIn too, enough to tease that recruiter to say, wow, this person looks like they may have what we need. I need to find out more, versus giving them too much and they're saying, holy smokes, they're all over the place. I'm not sure if they'd be interested in what we have here.
Well, Bruce, if this were a union job, they might say, okay, you're due your coffee break now, so we're going to pause quickly for a few important messages and return with more of the 12 good steps to landing that dream job. Bruce Lockin, our career coach, with us this morning. You can join, too, at 888-914-9149. More coming up right here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Looking at life from a Catholic worldview,
this is Morning Air
with John Morales, Sarah Tafoya, and Glenn Leverett.
Sweet dreams are made.
Patrick and Cyrus coming up after the news headlines at the top of the hour. Morning Air continues now. John with the day off. It's Glenn and Sarah hanging out with Bruce Lockenow, our career coach, joining us with 12 steps to land that dream job. Looking today at those with a little more experience and some of the special challenges they face. Bruce, maybe combining a couple of steps here, but the need for that concise elevator pitch to be able to say what we do, how we can help others, to do that very quickly. And we're thinking, well, that's really handy in an elevator, literally at a convention perhaps, but in the summertime here, and thinking of working on our networking, that can even be at a backyard barbecue.
Absolutely. And for the experienced worker, again, keeping it focused, we have a lot of stuff that we've done, but we want to focus that elevator pitch on specifically what we're seeking. It's tight, it's energetic, it's crisp, and it leaves them wanting more. So now that experienced worker has got a network to be envied. And the degrees of separation to get to what they need to get to are a lot tighter than that earlier, than somebody earlier in their career, Glenn. So you're right, networking is always critical. So I got a great example of this. A buddy of mine with whom I play golf on occasion when we're both in town, had found out that his group was sort of being eliminated, at least frozen, and then it looked like they were gonna, the handwriting was on the wall. So we spoke, he took the steps that you and I just talked about, Glenn, on the resume, made it tight, and dropped some of the early stuff and didn't put years on school, and then lit up his network. And he has, and this is just recently, in fact, he's taking the month of August, he had three opportunities, took one of them, and agreed to take the month of August off. So he's wrapping up his current job, taking the month of August off, and then starting in September. So the source of most jobs are through a network. So you know, you can look at postings. I don't discourage people from applying to postings, but it's really, really hard. The odds are against you. Those postings, though, can show you where the jobs are, what sectors are hot for folks that have got your experience, your competencies, and your passion. So that's not bad. But then when you see what it is, go on to LinkedIn. Find out who you know and reach out to them. Because when somebody comes in to a hiring manager and says, boy, I know Glenn Leverance, he is dynamite. You got to meet him. Guess what? You're going to get that meeting.
Oh, I love to hear you say that. That's just awesome. Awesome as well. Now, hopefully, Bruce, older workers know this by now, but for anyone, maybe that reminder, don't burn your bridges in terms of networking. There might be some places, jobs that weren't great or some coworkers that were difficult, and you might be happy to not have to work with them again. But time and time again, I have worked with the same people at different jobs. Time and time again, I've hired some of the same people at a couple different stations over time. But just maybe to reiterate the importance of don't burn those bridges.
Keep that network alive. I'll take it one step further. So, and that's the last step we have is about popping the champagne. And one of the things you want to do is let everybody know, thank them. Let them know about your new job. Thank them for their help in the process. And I would suggest that you keep that network alive down the road. Maybe a year into the new job, you shoot out an email or an update and say, just want to let everybody thank everyone yet again, because this dream job certainly has turned out to be all that I had hoped it would be. Because down the road, you know, not only may you need them, but they may need you. So it's well, that's great advice, Glenn. Absolutely.
as a career coach. You're employed as a headhunter, Bruce. But talk a little bit about the difference. Some people might think of a headhunter as an agent, but headhunters work for the employer. And, you know, we sometimes we might wish for an agent. Oh, it's hard looking for work. I wish somebody could just do that for me. But important to realize that's not the headhunter's job.
No, and, you know, going through these 12 steps, you can do it for yourself, and it will work, I assure you, based on experience. Headhunters for experienced workers may not be the best use of time. So earlier in a person's career, as they're humming along in their 30s and 40s, early 40s, headhunters could be a nice source of opportunities, and relationship investing time in relationships there is time well spent. Later in life, though, they'll carry that bias that's out there from their employers into their search process. So I would discourage our experienced workers from investing a lot of time with headhunters, because not only do you have to convince the headhunter of the fact that you address all those stereotypes and that you've got that, but then you're relying on that you've got what they need, the employer needs, but then you're relying on that headhunter to do the same thing with a hiring manager. It's just, the odds are just too low. I think there are better uses of people's time.
Running through the list here of some good steps before we run out of time again this week, Bruce. As far as tips on, you know, not coming across as an experienced worker, too overconfident even in the interview.
Yeah, you're right. So step six is nailing that interview. So you got the job description. It's the answer key to the interview. You want to have your anecdotes ready. So you do the same careful preparation that anyone would do, but there's a survey out there that says that experienced workers are viewed as overconfident in their abilities and experience, and as there's a concern that mature workers may be resistant to taking direction from younger management. Best way to address that is, instead of coming into that interview and being a know-it-all or sounding like a know-it-all, engage, ask questions. Ask questions about, okay, how's this opening, you know, affecting you and others on your team? What are the challenges that are going to have to be addressed, and how do you think it's the best way to address them? You're actually demonstrating the fact that you are engaged and not overconfident, and that you're eager to learn, and that you know that each situation is different, because our experienced workers are going to have a lot of anecdotes, but you don't want to just pile them on and appear like you're coming in with a playbook, but rather you're coming in to understand a situation and help solve it based on your experience.
I've cautioned people heading into an interview to not talk too much, to answer the questions, but to let the interviewer continue to lead that conversation.
No, great advice. And again, I would say not only not talk, but ask questions. You know, get engaged. You know, start discussing the issues and ways to solve them. That, you know, you're kind of taking that interview and making it a session where they see how you work. Versus lecturing. Again, you got to be careful, because there will be assumptions that will be applied to experienced workers.
Bruce, as far as compensation and negotiation, kind of good to know the rough range we're working with too as we go in, right?
Yeah, Glenn, absolutely. Not only the rough range, you can get focused on a fine point of what the compensation is through sites and through finding people who have done the job and maybe left, and they're pretty forthcoming. So that data is out there. So you need to have that data. But what's different with experienced workers is, you know, the negotiation methodology I suggest is exactly the same, which is trying to create a problem-solving situation rather than an adversarial negotiation. However, we talked about that overqualified. People may assume that an experienced worker is going to need to be overly remunerated or paid very well. I would suggest, you know, as you understand what the situation, what the compensation is for this particular role, that you maybe let them know that, and know that works for you, and or you find a way to structure a compensation package so that you might have a lower base salary, but you have performance bonuses tied to achieving some objectives, because that just reinforces that you're confident that you can help figure out the situation and achieve what they need done. So. You know, the other thing is, Glenn, as we talk about this, in this job environment, is don't go from the frying pan to the fire. We talked about, you know, a worker who says, hey, should I gut it out for the last 5 years before retirement? If they're looking right now, because the economic climate is changing, you know, make sure that where you're going is one that's going to do well and survive through, and that job will survive through a downturn. So you don't want to go into mortgage lending. You know, all the markets right now, all the sectors right now that are turning south are not ones that you're going to want to go into.
Hey, Bruce, we'll have to have you back. We're not going to get through the entire list, which is a good tease for next week. Lord willing, that would be awesome. But a final question in terms of compensation for an experienced worker. Can there be an agreement that, you know, okay, the employer maybe can't afford as much as that person is worth, but the potential employee can ease the fear back by saying, hey, I just wanted to try and do this type of work that I really enjoy for just a few more years, and come to an agreement that it isn't going to be just all about the money, but someone that has the experience but just enjoys the work?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Glenn. And, you know, I think you need to be creative, because it may be, you know, you may want to go to try it and let's see if you like it for the employer. Say, this is a passion of mine. I love doing this. Let's do it on a contract basis, and you know, a monthly rate of whatever it is, or an hourly rate, and see where it leads us. Because this is fun. I love doing this, and I'm confident that I can help ease that those pain points that you have. So the whole compensation negotiation is a little bit different than it is earlier on in someone's career. You do need to be, as you suggest, you do need to be creative. But what one thing I would say, though, is not to suggest that you're going to be a short timer, because that's one of the stereotypes that are out there, is that if I hire this person, they're only going to work for a year or two. No. I mean, the beauty of most experienced workers, Glenn, unlike the up-and-coming workforce, is that experienced workers have had several stints in their career where they work for a good 5 years plus and can talk about how they came in and solve problems and saw them through. I think that's what you want to make
clear.
Got to
run right now,
too.
Bruce, but thank you so much for your time today. Got to squeeze in that good story corner. More with Bruce next week here.
You bet, Glenn. Okay, thank you so much.
Our story today is called Ruth. Ruth went to her mailbox, found only one letter. She picked it up and looked at it, just saw the envelope, had no stamp or postmark, just her name and address. And so she read, "Dear Ruth, I'm going to be in your neighborhood Saturday afternoon. I'd love to stop by for a visit. Love always, Jesus." Her hands were shaking as she placed the letter on her table. Why would the Lord want to visit me? I'm nobody special. I don't have anything to offer. Well, that thought, Ruth remembered her empty kitchen cabinets. Oh my goodness, I really don't have anything to offer. I'll have to run down to the store and buy something for dinner. She reached for her purse, counted out the contents, a full $5.40. Well, I can get some bread and cold cuts at least, she thought, so she threw on her coat and hurried out the door and came back with a loaf of French bread, a half pound of sliced turkey, and a carton of milk, and 12 cents to last till Monday. Nonetheless, she felt great as she headed home, her meager offerings tucked under her arm, when she heard, "Hey, lady, can you help us, lady?" Ruth had been so absorbed in her plans, she hadn't noticed the two figures huddled in the alleyway, a man and woman both dressed in little more than rags. "Look, lady, I ain't got a job. You know, my wife and I have been out here on the street, and it's getting cold. We're kind of hungry. If you could help us, we'd really appreciate it." And Ruth looked at them both. They were dirty, smelled bad, and frankly, she was certain they could get some kind of job if they really wanted to. "I'd like to help you, sir, but I'm a poor woman myself. All I have is a few cold cuts and some bread, and I've got an important guest coming for dinner." "Yeah, okay, lady, I understand. Thanks anyway." And the man put his arm around the woman's shoulders and turned and headed back to the alley. As she watched him leave, Ruth felt a familiar twinge in her heart. "Sir, wait!" The couple stopped and turned as she ran down the alley after them. "Look, why don't you take this food?" she said. "I'll figure out something else to get to my guest." She handed them her grocery bag. "Well, thanks, lady. Thank you very much." "Yes, thank you," said the man's wife. Ruth now could see that she was shivering, and she said, "You know, I've got another coat at home. Here, why don't you take this one?" So Ruth unbuttoned her jacket and slipped it over the woman's shoulders. And then smiling, she turned and walked back to the street without her coat and nothing to serve her guest. "Thank you, lady. Thank you very much." Ruth was chilled by the time she reached her front door and worried, too. The Lord was coming to visit, and she didn't have anything to offer. She fumbled for her key and then saw in her mailbox there was another envelope. "Well, that's odd. The mailman doesn't usually stop twice in one day." She took out the envelope, opened it, and read, "Dear Ruth, it was very nice visiting you today. Thank you for the delicious meal and the coat, which kept me warm all night. Love always, Jesus." Matthew 25:40 says, "The king will reply, 'Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these my brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me.'" That's our story today. Stick around. Patrick Madrid up after the news next at Relevant Radio.